Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to download us and join us this week. Our goal is to bring you interesting people in the world of exercise science and health, and this week is no exception. We have today with us Captain Julianne Gillespie from the U.S. Air Force with us. Welcome, Julianne.
Hello.
It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Super. I'm gonna tell the audience a little bit about you, so they know kind of why we have you on, and then we'll just launch into our conversation here.
Captain Gillespie is an aerospace physiologist in the Air Force, and she works as a flight commander, and she works with the F-22 Raptor group there at Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida.
And the reason that we have her on today is she suffered through a few of my classes as a student way back when, and she is a registered clinical exercise physiologist, has a master's degree in clinical exercise physiology from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. And so we're going to talk to her today about being an exercise scientist in the Air Force. Does that sound good for you, Julianne?
It sounds great. I'm excited.
So let's just get started here. So how does being an exercise physiologist translate into working into the military?
Well, it's not just necessarily exercise physiology, but really any background somebody would have in the sciences. So biology would be one of those examples. So any type of anatomy and physiology that somebody could have and translate that into a high-altitude environment, a high-gravitational force environment, just having that basic foundation of physiology and the sciences to translate it, that into maybe something a little bit different is really kind of beneficial for somebody that would be looking into this career field.
Well, now you are in the Air Force. You're dealing with aerospace physiology in high-G environments because you're working with a fighter group there. Has your exercise physiology background given you any advantages to that? Why did you go into this?
Well, I went into it because I heard about it while I was in grad school there at UNC Charlotte, and I thought it sounded really cool. So looking into it more and talking to a recruiter, I found out that, hey, this is a way to use my physiology background and move it into maybe something a little bit different from exercise. And although I do work with my exercise physiology background, I do have to translate it into a little bit different of a mindset. But I just thought it was something neat and interesting to do, and that's kind of why I jumped into it.
Now, I know from past history that there has been, we talk about application of exercise to pilots. What are the general guidelines for exercise in pilots in the Air Force, especially in fighter planes? Do you let them do anything they want to do?
Well, as long as they stay in good shape, that's really kind of what we're looking for. And as we know with exercise physiology, everybody's different. Everybody's goals are different. And what people have to work on to be elite are different. So we try to make excess prescriptions for those that need it. But really, these pilots flying the F-22 are so high level of athletes that there's very little that we have to do here. However, we do try to make sure that they have a very strong muscular strength portion of their exercise, especially for their lower body and their core. So we try to focus on that more than aerobic training, although it is obviously vital to have aerobic training as well.
So why do you focus on resistance training?
The main reason for that is when you pull G's, or those gravitational forces that we talked about earlier, when you do that, those are called positive G's, the main ones that they kind of sustain. And when that occurs, the blood in your body will pull from your head down to your lower body.
Doesn't sound comfortable.
It does not. I went through the centrifuge, and it's not very nice. But the main thing they have to do while they're flying, and that happens, to make sure that they don't pass out, essentially, is to push that blood back up to the brain. And to do that, they have to do an isometric contraction with their lower body and their core to kind of shoot that blood back up from where it was pulling from. So having a anaerobic conditioning program, especially looking at the lower body, as I mentioned, is vital for those pilots.
So while they're flying, they're doing isometric contractions to try to stay conscious?
Yes.
Okay, interesting. It's not really exercise as much as it's survival methods, isn't it?
It is. It's a survival method. However, I would still say that it's kind of like a workout. Being under that amount of pressure due to G-forces, upwards of 9 Gs, and having to do that isometric contraction is really like a workout. So these guys are athletes. Just as some people wouldn't think that a race car driver was an athlete, some people might not think that a pilot was an athlete, but they definitely are doing some exercises up there for sure.
Now they're not only depending on these isometric contractions to maintain blood flow, are they?
No, they also have to perform a breathing technique, which will further increase their inner thoracic blood pressure, and that helps to push the blood up to their brain as well. And that's the main reason that we don't necessarily have them doing a ton of aerobic conditioning, because if their blood pressure is too low, it might make them not necessarily be able to increase that blood flow like they need to.
So does the Air Force limit the amount of aerobic conditioning that the pilots can do?
No, they don't. And actually, I've seen several pilots that do a lot of aerobic conditioning. And as we mentioned, how everybody's a little bit different.
Yeah.
There's guys that are triathletes and are in tremendous shape and do a lot of aerobic stuff, but are still able to pull G-forces. And I think it just comes down to everybody's personal anatomy and physiology as well as the workouts they're doing.
If you got a pilot on the flight line and he's on the flight line continuously, do they get better at handling these G-forces? Or?
Absolutely. It's like anything else. If you play a sport for a long period of time, your muscles kind of gain that muscle memory of doing some of the techniques that you're used to. So absolutely, if they're pulling G's for several years, they will be better at it than somebody who's just starting out. So you definitely want to make sure these guys are flying as much as they can to maintain that muscle memory that their muscles have, to ensure they don't necessarily have to work as hard as somebody that's just starting out.
And now, does when these pilots aren't flying, or do you put them in a centrifuge regularly to try to keep that G tolerance up, or are there other kind of training methods they do to try to maintain themselves between their times on the flight line?
Well, they fly typically enough to maintain that. They really only go through the centrifuge once, and that's initially to make sure they can pass the qualifications of pulling the G-forces they need to for their particular aircraft. Unless they've been out of the jet for several years, then they might have to go back to requalify.
So you just said something that's interesting. So there are specific G-force qualifications for each kind of plane they fly?
Yes, sir, only for the fighter pilots. So if you're flying a heavier aircraft, obviously you're not going to be pulling G-forces to where you'd have to qualify. But any fighter pilot, so for the Raptor, the F-16, the F-15, they need to qualify at 9 G-forces. Other aircraft might not hit that amount of Gs, so they might not need to qualify that high.
Yeah, let's hope some of the big planes don't pull those kind of Gs.
That would be bad.
Yeah. If they're pulling those kind of genes, there's other kind of troubles, aren't there?
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about this. What happens when we're kind of focusing a little bit on the extreme G-forces right now, but that's really kind of a fascinating physiological state. So you talk about having to pump blood to the brain. What happens when that doesn't work right or doesn't happen?
If that doesn't happen, it's called a G-lock, which stands for G-induced loss of consciousness. So it's really just passing out because you don't have enough blood and oxygen going to your brain, as what would happen if you lost too much blood. And, you know, we really just call that hypoxia, not having enough blood and O2 going to the brain to keep you awake. So if that happens while they're flying, it's pretty bad news. And that's why we really try to make sure these guys are in shape enough to decrease their risk for that. They're never going to be in a position where it's not going to happen, but we try to make sure they're in good enough shape to where they decrease that risk from occurring.
Now, we keep using the descriptor guys for these pilots, but there are some women in the flight line, aren't there?
There are. However, there, as of right now, are no women that I'm aware of that fly in the F-22. But there are women fighter pilots, absolutely. So I should say pilots and not guys. I guess I get used to that around here. But you're absolutely right. There are women that are flying and that are fighter pilots.
Well, but that was leading to my next question, and that is, are there any gender differences in G tolerance and some of the responses to these high performance G environments?
Well, due to the fact that men usually have more muscular strength, they probably have an easier time with kind of shunting that blood back up to the brain. However, if somebody is shorter, they might have an easier time than a taller individual due to the distance from the heart to the brain of being able to pump that blood would be a shorter distance. So it really just depends on anatomy and physiology, as I mentioned. However, there are really tall dudes that are, or females that are fighter pilots and don't have a problem. So it just comes down, I think, to every individual.
Everybody has a little bit different inherent G tolerance.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's switch back to, you mentioned something very briefly about how you were in school at Charlotte and got interested in this area. We have a lot of people that listen to these podcasts that are interested in how you got to where you are. We may have people that say, you know, I'd like to do that. That sounds really cool. So if we have somebody listening that says, you know, I'd like to become an aerospace physiologist in the Air Force, what's the process?
The process would be, first of all, to find a recruiter. And if you want this job, to specifically find an officer recruiter, because you would come in as a commissioned officer rather than enlist. Therefore, if you are an officer, you have to have a degree. So definitely find an officer recruiter is the main thing that I can tell somebody, and I will stomp that and stomp it and stomp it, because there'll be several enlisted recruiters that will try to recruit you to enlist, and you won't necessarily be in this specific job. So you really just got to be careful, get the information on your own as well as talking to several people so that you can make sure you're getting the correct information. And really just go to an Air Force base, if you can, that has aerospace physiology, and talk to the officers there and just try to get as much information as you can to formulate your opinion. I right now have a gentleman who's in graduate school. He's hanging out with us for a few days, and he's interested in the program, and that's what he's doing, just sitting in our classes and trying to get a feel for what we do.
So when you finished your graduate degree, did they just automatically commission you and put you on the flight line as a flight commander, or what was the process?
A little bit more of a process. When I talked to my recruiter, I had to get a whole package together to be able to, first of all, be accepted. I drove up to Washington, D.C. to have an interview with the leader of our career field. So I got accepted for that. And shortly after I was accepted, I went to OTS, which stands for Officer Training School, in Maxwell, Alabama. And that
Garden Spotted South.
Absolutely. It was hot and humid.
Oh, okay.
After that, I went to the physiology course, which is about 6 weeks long. And then shortly after that, I was then stationed at my base. And then you do a lot of on-the-job training, because let's be honest, when you go to school, you don't really get a degree in aerospace physiology. So there's a lot that you have to learn on the job, and that's what I did. And there's a few things you have to get signed off on before you're a fully qualified physiologist, but you just kind of have to work through it.
You know, one of the old sayings with the military recruiting was that join the military and see the world. You've seen quite a bit of the world, haven't you?
I have. I've gone TDY, which stands for temporary duty, which means you just go for a few weeks to different assignments. So I've gone TDY to several locations, a lot to San Antonio, Ohio, several places in Florida, Alabama, and I soon will be moving this summer to Washington State.
Wow.
Yeah.
But the good thing is you haven't been deployed overseas yet, huh?
I have not. Nope. A lot of people, it's a positive and a negative thing. Some people enjoy being deployed to better further their education on what we're doing and get a different grasp for the job. But some people rather just stay with their family. So it's a positive and a negative depending on who the individual is that wants to join this career field. But we really don't deploy that frequently.
So what's been the biggest surprise
that you had being in the military?
The biggest surprise, I think, would be the amount of leadership skills that are really required to be an officer. And it's a good thing, though, and I've gained a lot of experience with supervising individuals and just learning how to be a leader and an officer. Because when you talk about the military, you're that first. You're an officer first, and then you're your job.
Yeah. We always try on the podcast to, I think, personalize these podcasts a bit, and we always ask our guest about any humorous situation or situations they will always remember as part that they probably didn't expect. Do you have any stories like that?
Really just torturing air crew is sometimes funny.
Oh, torturing the air crew. Oh, okay.
We have an altitude chamber here at Tyndall, and we take them to 25,000 feet, allow them to get hypoxic, and that whole experience is interesting to see how the air crew react when they have a lack of oxygen going to their brain. So anything from euphoria to belligerence to passing out, which we try to avoid, obviously,
right.
But sometimes it's unavoidable. So just really watching that happen on a weekly basis is intriguing.
Have you gone through that?
Yes, I have. I have gone through the centrifuge as well as the altitude chamber and several other torture devices.
So what is it like to go 25,000 feet without oxygen?
Well, if you don't have oxygen, you can't be up there for too long because you will get hypoxic and eventually pass out. But it is interesting to feel the effects of hypoxia if you've never done that before.
Did you get belligerent or were you euphoric?
I would say I was more euphoric. It was more of a, this feels really nice than me wanting to beat somebody up, which is probably a bad thing. I don't know if it's good to feel good when you're hypoxic because you might not recognize that it's a bad thing that's occurring.
So you were a happy euphoric individual is what you're saying?
I was.
Yeah. So we're running short of time here, and as we also always ask our guests to do, and that's to provide us with a take-home message. Have you got something that you would like the people listening to this podcast to always remember?
I would say my take-home message would be really just the fact that you can never have too much education, and if something scares you, like going into the military and doing aerospace physiology, do it, because you're going to get a lot more experience in education than maybe being a personal trainer or working in cardiac rehab. So it's okay to be scared sometimes and just take those leaps forward to do something new and different.
Great. Great take-home message. And Julianne, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
We've enjoyed having you on. It's always nice talking to former students who have gone on and done great things. And so really congratulations on your career so far. We're looking forward to watching it as it continues to progress.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. And for all those that are listening, again, we want to thank you for taking the time to download us. And you are all probably waiting with bated breath to hear the podcast question of the week. And so here's our producer, Kelly, with that question.
What areas of the body are most important to resistance train in fighter pilots?
Excellent podcast question there. Be the first one to send us the correct answer via email to the address huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. And again, thank you, Julianne.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you all for listening to us. We hope that you will join us next week when we have another interesting person from the world of exercise science, human performance, and health. And until then, we ask you and we hope that you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.